BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. Let's say you're the Prime Minister and I'm the Cabinet Secretary and we have 28 minutes to get the best briefing we can on a big subject. Happens all the time. So we call the clearest minds into one room and ask them to take us through it. That room is the briefing room. And here we are. Our question today, when we end up leaving the EU, or even if eventually we don't, what will Britain's place in the world look like? And if you enjoy this podcast, you might enjoy other editions of The Briefing Room, which are all available on BBC Sounds. This week, inside The Briefing Room, we're not looking at what's going on in the Palace of Westminster. There are plenty of excellent BBC colleagues and others doing that already. We're going to get an idea of Britain's future in the world once it has been resolved, how we will leave the EU, or even if eventually we don't. Those discussions have barely begun yet, but they'll define ours and our children's future. Who will we trade with and how? What will have happened to our influence in the world? Who will our friends and closest partners be? Step inside The Briefing Room to find out. To take me and you through all this, I have four experts in their fields. Nairi Woods is the Dean of the Blavatnik School of Government at Oxford University. Sam Lowe is Senior Research Fellow at the Centre for European Reform, a think tank. Meg Russell is the Director of the Constitution Unit at University College London. And for The View from Europe, we're also joined by Stephanie Bolton, London correspondent of German newspaper Die Welt. The first question I want to put to you, Nairi Woods, is and the first area is about trade. Now, when we think about what the general rules of thumb for a country of our size seeking to optimise its trading position, what would we say they were?
Well, it's, you know, the first key thing is what's the negotiation power you've got to open other people's markets? People imagine that the world is some kind of free market, but it's not. Any more than when you get in your car in the morning and drive on the roads, you can do whatever you like. No, you obey the rules of the road, and those rules of the road are carefully negotiated among countries. So Britain will have to establish rules of the road, first and foremost with its European partners. And I think that's the first thing that needs to be understood, no matter what the outcome of what's happening in Parliament. If you get a no deal, that's just Britain ripping up the rule book as it is and starting right from scratch and saying we'll negotiate every single rule. That will take decades. Then you've got a whole slew of deals which are about let's agree to keep some of the rules that we've got and we'll renegotiate the others. And that will necessarily mean a host of negotiations. Or, of course, you just keep the rule book that you've got. But trade only happens when you've got those rules established. So what Britain's going to need to do is to really think about what the rules of its engagement with other countries are going to be. And what makes that hard is the world is changing very fast. And as we just heard on the news, China has emerged as a huge player, and China itself is setting different kinds of rules around the world. And the United States, under President Trump, is setting a second very different set of America First rules. So the rules even that we thought existed in 2016 when the referendum took place, which were rules of a global market economy in which we could compete with other countries, including our European partners, have very quickly shifted under our feet.
How did we seek to achieve a position whereby we could, if you like, be part of the rule givers in the period before we were in the European community?
Well, Britain's got a great history on it. Obviously, when Britain controlled its empire, it did set the rules of the game across the world. Once it lost the empire, it did it by sitting right next to the United States at the end of the Second World War and the 1.5 parties of the United States and Britain. Then, by the 1970s, it did so by joining with its European neighbours, and as the European Union, negotiating as one voice. That's what the customs union means. And so Britain's had those three models. Now it would seem that there are some in Britain that would like to cut loose from all of the above because the United States is not offering that kind of relationship. And Britain no longer has an empire. So it's charting what some would call a courageous course if we take that action.
Now, you talked about how long it would take to create new rules or to negotiate new rules with other countries. You sort of said it would take years. I mean, when you say take years, how many years does it take? How long a period of transition are we talking about?
Well, if you look at the political agreement and you look at the 14 different chapters on trade, you start getting a sense of why it takes a long time to negotiate trade agreements. Because each area, transport, energy, fishing, global cooperation, goods, services, investment, financial services, each of these things, you can't just send politicians off to Brussels or to New Delhi to negotiate any old rules. Every rule is going to affect every community in Britain. It's going to affect whether the food they eat, which is imported from another country, is safe. It's going to affect whether they can establish a business under certain kinds of rules and then hope to export abroad. It will affect everybody. And for that reason, good trade rules need quite a lot of negotiation, not just with another country, but back home with all the different communities at home.
If I could turn to you, Sam. What we've heard there is we're a medium-sized nation seeking to negotiate rules with much bigger players, almost no matter what option we take. What does this tell us about the long-term options that could be negotiated? Norway, people talk about with the what they call the EEA, Canada, the version, the World Trade Organization rules, and so on.
Well, I think what it tells us is that our future relationship with the rest of the world, so excluding the EU, is contingent on our relationship with the European Union. So, for example, if we were to go a Canada-style route, so we would have a free trade agreement with the EU, and you would then have some other things in place for Northern Ireland, you would have some freedom then to explore trade agreements with other countries, such as the US, potentially. But you would be putting up barriers with the European Union, putting up barriers to trade with the European Union in order to bring them down with others. And the fundamental question that needs to be asked here is that a good idea economically? And economically speaking, there's no evidence to suggest that a deep relationship with the US is preferable to one with the EU, because the EU is near and big. But politically speaking, especially for some of those who have proposed Brexit and have pushed it this whole way, these new trade agreements are trophies that can show that something good can come from Brexit.
But can you turn them from trophies to being something which is makes you a kind of realistic partner? I mean, can you, as a country of our size, chart a way into agreements with large players like America and then other medium-sized players who are not in the European Union, such that you effectively kind of create your own circle of rule creation and your own trade conditions?
No, I think that's probably too optimistic. If we think about the world as it exists, there's two, I refer to them as regulatory superpowers. These are economies big enough to export their rules beyond their own borders just by sheer market size. So you want to sell to them, you converge. And that's the European Union and the US. China is going to become one, but is probably not there yet. So for the UK going forward, it's probably going to have to choose slightly who it wants to align itself with. In certain specific areas, it might be able to be a trailblazer if it's targeted and thinks it through. But otherwise, it's probably going to have to choose. And in reality, we are going to stay within the EU's geography in its regulatory gravity field for quite a long while, no matter the deal we have with the European Union.
So what you're saying is, no matter what the final outcome is, let's say that we were to take what people call the WTO option, etc., we would still find ourselves like a kind of planet in orbit around these other bigger planets, forced in a sense to take account of what they were doing, and essentially to shape our own rules to suit them.
And absolutely. And the EU is probably one of the most successful exporter of its own rules. So to just give a few examples, when it comes to chemicals policy, China is following suit with the EU's approach, as is Korea. There's this one example that the Americans really don't like, but when it comes to making whiskey, if you want to sell it in the EU, you have to have aged it in a barrel for 3 years. And the US say they can do it quicker, if you want to call it whiskey. And the US say they can go do it quicker. But the reason they really dislike it is that Russia have taken on board this rule as well, as of Israel.
Nairi Woods, you were talking earlier about how some of, and had hinted at some of the major changes that were taking place in the world economy anyway. And you'd got as far as talking about the rise of China. And I imagine there's also, in terms of the kinds of goods that will be traded or the kinds of services that will be created in the new technological world. If we were, by one mechanism or another, to stay in the European Union, how will the EU's own trade position have to be developed as a consequence of those changes?
Well, I would describe the biggest change as a change from a kind of rule-based global economy to one of strategic competition, where big countries are competing for control of economic growth, for control of resources and access to resources, and control of the rules of the game. And so what China's doing is investing hundreds of billions of dollars of government, of state funding, to building these huge infrastructure routes that give it control of resources and that permit it to continue on its economic growth. And that means that the world economy itself is shifting, that it's much more difficult for a country on its own to compete in that set of rules. So if Britain does stay within the European Union, at least it gets a bigger place in that strategic competition. But that said, the European Union itself needs to recognise that new world of strategic competition. At the moment, the two big tech giants in the world are Alibaba from China and Google from the United States. They're both competing to hire, quite often, European engineers. But it's quite important that Europe does not yet have a tech giant, because that is the economy of the future. The control of data, the control of artificial intelligence, and the ability to use those to generate growth are going to be one of the terrains in which the new strategic competition takes place.
And are we in Britain helpful towards creation, the possible creation of such a giant or such a position?
Absolutely. I mean, Britain and some other European countries have been very good at generating small startups in the technology space, startups which almost immediately are bought by Google or other tech giants, either in the United States or now increasingly it's China that's looking in to do that. I think what Europe's going to need to do is take a strategic view on this and stop thinking deal by deal and start thinking, what does the 10-year plan look like?
Okay, so that's a situation that would face us even if we were to stay in the European Union. Let's talk now a bit about influence in the world and political influence. Sam, the UK long had a key strategy. I remember Tony Blair talking about it, John Major talking about it, be at the heart of Europe, while somehow dodging the bits of Europe that we didn't like. Why did we have that strategy? Why was that what we wanted to do?
I think the theory behind it was that in this sort of global world with these big powers, to have sovereignty, and in this sense I would understand sovereignty as being the ability to change the winds, to affect the winds that blow you around. And when it comes to these global winds, you need to align yourself with a bigger group, with a bigger grouping. And that's what they attempted to do within Europe to varying degrees of success. And I think the issue the UK has now is actually, in the short to medium run, we're actually just going to be treading water for a while, because from the moment we leave, the first thing we have to do is actually replace all of the existing agreements that the existing free trade agreements that the EU has. And then we have to sort out our agreement with the EU in parallel. And it's only then we really get to think about, what do we want to do with the rest of the world? And at the moment, we're just rushing into sort of saying, well, we want to do something with the US, we want to do Australia, we want to do New Zealand, but why?
Well, I think we should come on to where that leads us in a moment. But I'd like to ask Stephanie Bolton this. From a European perspective, how successful has Britain, or unsuccessful has Britain been, in influencing how the European Union has developed in its policies?
It has been very influential, obviously, because of history. If you talk about the Maastricht Treaty, about the single market, Britain has had a massive footprint of how Europe has developed. Or if you look at the European enlargement, it was very much also a Tony Blair project. And long years, it was also very much promoted by Britain to get Turkey, maybe one day, into the European Union. In that sense, I think it's the global outlook that Britain brought into the European project. And because of Britain's history and the Commonwealth and the special transatlantic partnership, it was a very, very influential voice at the table, also because of the military power that Britain has. When it came to integration, obviously, as Sam just said, Britain had a very good deal because they dodged the stuff they didn't like the euro, being in Schengen, certain things in the social and justice chapters. But that was kind of accepted, you know. It was, at least from a German perspective, that was something because, okay, if the Brits did not want to join that, that was okay, because they were important in other things. For example, for Germany, very important when it came to budget negotiations. Then Germany and Britain was always very close.
Does that mean that Britain actually could say things which maybe Germany wanted to say but didn't, and therefore, as a consequence, they got done?
Yes, of course. There was a lot of behind closed doors negotiations, especially when the 7-year financial framework was talked about. Obviously, there were times that were more difficult. When you look at the Iraq war, Germany and Britain were not on the same sheet. But in general, I think not only politically, also culturally, Germany needed Britain to be at the table to, as they say, make sure that the Club Med would not take over the European Union.
The Club Med, right. I think most of us would like the Club Med to take over everything, really, especially at the moment. Sam, looking ahead, we're out. Let's say we're out. Maybe it's a kind of, as some people talk about, a Norway or a Switzerland-type relationship. What do those relationships tell us about how you can use influence or how you are influenced by the European Union?
Well, I suppose if you're in a Switzerland or Norway style relationship with the European Union, the influence is much more structured, as in there are structures built into those agreements. Or if we would have a Swiss type agreement, it looks slightly different from what the Swiss have now and would look more like what the EU hope that looks like in the future, where there is more structure.
Wow, that's confusing.
Within it. Yeah, sorry. The existing Swiss arrangement is not something the EU particularly want to replicate because it's a mess of multiple different treaties. But if we take Norway, you have these formal structures by which the UK can contribute to dialogues on different rulemaking in different settings, on different bits of rulemaking, and will be brought into the room, but won't necessarily have a vote over it, but would have more influence over the rules than, say, if we were to be in a free trade agreement.
Can I put the suggestion to you that if it was Britain that was in the Norway position, because it's such a much larger country, we might have significantly more influence than Norway does?
Arguably, and I would also say that we talk about Norway as this off-the-shelf option. I think my feeling is that if the UK was to go into a similar agreement, it would actually be bespoke to the UK, because Norway works for Norway, the EEA-EFTA agreement works for Norway, but for a big economy like the British, who are known for throwing their toys out of the pram, they're going to need a bit more written into it. We might share some of the structures, share some of the institutions, but I do think it would be bespoke. But
Nari Woods, do you agree with that?
Yes, I mean, very different economies. You know, Norway is a big oil economy. Britain is a services economy, 80% services. So Britain actually needs the single market much more than Norway.
Stephanie Motson, if by any chance we stayed in the EU at the end of this process, would we find that EU attitudes had changed towards us? Would we have lost some influence or gained some influence?
I think that the last 2 years have really left some scars. There is a lot of distrust. There has been a lot of impatience. I thought it was very interesting. I attended the last council last week in Brussels, and it was interesting because the agenda of the council was different. They were not going to talk about Brexit beyond the dinner, and then they completely changed the agenda. They sat down. They said, "We have to sort this out." And afterwards, you could feel this impatience and also the mistrust, I must say. And that's why they were so adamant on this deadline of April 12th to say, by then we need to know if you are going to participate in the European election.
So did you have the feeling, so as I said, let's say that for one reason or another, Brexit doesn't actually happen in the end, as some people think is possible. Would the European Union want to admit Britain back into the kind of fullest influential councils of Europe that it enjoyed before?
Well, if it was still a member, of course, legally it would be at these tables. But what I think is now difficult is that everybody knows how split the country is about the European Union. So that banging on about Europe would definitely go on.
Now, Europe... one of the problems that existed before the referendum was the discussion about how Europe was inevitably heading for further integration, particularly because of the problems in the Eurozone. Is it your perception that that is what is now under discussion with Britain out of the way?
Well, arguably, there is more integration talk in terms of security and defence. And that's something some, especially in France, might welcome, because Britain was always a blocking power in terms of European integration in the military field. But if you look at what has really been on the table, there was this treaty lately between France and Germany in Aachen. If you look at the content, it is quite shallow. It is not really going beyond that everything, all the projects that are already on the table. And when it comes to the euro reform, where you actually think there is integration needed, it's very difficult to implement that because there's a lot of row between France and Germany.
Okay, well, let's go on now to the question about what this process has told us about the future of the British internal settlement. Meg Russell, what do you read as being the major consequences for the British constitutional settlement, for Parliament and so on, arising out of the last 3 years?
That is a very big question. The argument that we've been having the last few weeks and months has been very much focused, obviously, on the relationship between the UK executive, the government and Parliament. And there's been a battle royal going on between the two, the like of which we've never really seen, or certainly not in modern times. And I think there's a sense of that relationship potentially being renegotiated. I think that these events have shown up a certain degree of sort of misunderstanding on the part of government about what its relationship with Parliament is. I mean, Parliament has, not least from the Prime Minister, been subject to significant criticism. But I think if there's part of the system that hasn't been working, actually, it's government, not Parliament. This week we've seen quite surprisingly organised and mature behaviour by parliamentarians to try and put some alternative options on the table. And we've seen a government which is effectively being very petulant and refusing to engage with that. And the fact is that the way, at the heart of our constitution is the relationship between government and parliament. And it's ultimately parliament that's in control, not government. But government seems not to have understood that, which is quite strange. It's the minority government situation that creates that.
Well, precisely. We've been used to a position, generally speaking, whereby governments have had majorities, which and those whip majorities generally delivered them their legislation.
And that creates an impression, often, that Parliament is weak and government is strong. But actually, because the government has a majority in Parliament, it's reliant on that majority. They tend to agree with each other. And often the flow of control is going the other way, but we don't get to see that. What we see in public is agreement. And at the moment, we've got a lot of disagreement. And Parliament is trying to assert what I think is its actual proper place to be holding government to account and indicating what our direction should be.
Now, that seems to suggest that although government could be conducted better, what we've been seeing is pretty much something of a model for what we are going to see from here on in. I mean, to give an example, let's say whatever happens with the first process of this discussion, there's going to be, unless we have we reverse this process, there's going to be a long discussion about over the next 2 years about what comes next. Now, how is that going to be handled constitutionally?
Well, I think that's very difficult. I mean, what we've been talking about, the mood has been very much a sort of talk of post-Brexit. There's absolutely no certainty that that's happening. I mean, Brexit looks further away than it has done at any time since 2016, and it's liable to be delayed, if not reversed altogether. But if we do get into a sort of post-Brexit situation, I think the Parliament is going to be much, much more watchful than it has been to date in terms of setting the boundaries of what the government can negotiate with its authority and so on. And if we've got a new Prime Minister, that could be extremely difficult, because if that's a Prime Minister who is more towards the Brexit end of the Conservative Party, that relationship looks to be so difficult, to be honest, that it's difficult to see how it could even survive.
And now I'm going to sound totally kind of ancient and constitutional, but that's what select committees were supposed to do, and then they were beefed up to do it even more. So how would that process, and you have to be quick about this, how would that process be managed?
Well, the select committees have been stepping up. They've been very active in the Brexit process. They've been very good at getting information out of government, getting things on the record, and the select committee chairs, people like Hilary Benn and Yvette Cooper, have been very visible in these debates. But I think that there are some very big challenges here for Parliament, because it generally has had this sort of backroom agreement with government, and things have been done very informally. I think one of the things we need is a beefing up of processes within Parliament to manage particularly minority government situations, a more sort of formalised relationship, if you like, between government and Parliament.
And that's all before we even discuss the position of the United Kingdom. We have the kind of really peculiar position whereby Northern Ireland voted to stay in the United Kingdom and is represented in Parliament almost entirely by people who want to come out. And the Scots who voted to stay in, but some of whom who defeated a referendum for independence, are forced to come out. Peter Hennessy, when he was on this programme a few weeks ago, said this is one of our major fault lines. Do you see it that way?
Yeah, well, I think that's true. And I think that the Brexit process, all of these debates, whatever happens with Brexit, have exposed major differences between the different parts of the United Kingdom. And the relationship with Scotland in particular has become incredibly difficult. And if we move to a post-Brexit situation, one of the things that's going to have to be strengthened in our our constitution is the framework of what we call intergovernmental relations, because there's going to be these frameworks required for things like agriculture policy, environment policy, and so on. And those frameworks, that those sort of negotiating mechanisms are currently extremely weak. But of course, I'm not convinced we are moving to a post-Brexit situation. But even if we don't, it's going to take some mending of those relationships.
Well, I'm going to ask you all a last question about this, what you've learned really from this process. Not what you think will happen. That would be a kind of preposterous thing. And you'd all say you didn't know and your guesses would be good for a week or so. But just what each of you think has been overlooked in the process of this discussion by journalists and by others that you really think needs to be reinserted into the discussion. And Sam, I've chosen you to answer first.
So I get quite frustrated at what I think of as, and someone else named, parliamentary Brexit comprehension deficit. So they seem to not understand things that people in the expert world have known for a long time. And specifically at the moment, people in Parliament seem to think that voting for, say, Norway, customs union or the like would obviate the need for the withdrawal agreement and the backstop. And they don't seem to realise it's a second order discussion. You start with withdrawal agreement, which includes the backstop, and then you discuss the future relationship.
And that's bigger. And as we've heard from Nairi Woods, could take years. Nairi Woods.
I think people don't look at the fact that the European Union is changing really fast. Poland, Hungary, Austria, Italy, the tensions between France and Germany. The European Union is changing fast, and the core interests of the Union lie in the single market, which gives the countries growth, and in the customs union, which enables Europe to negotiate with other parts of the world as a big power. No matter what happens in Britain, Britain will spend the next decade renegotiating its way to be part of that single market and customs union, because that's what the coming world requires Britain to have as a source of its own strength.
Okay. Stephanie Bolton.
I think I would like to say something more on a personal level. So I very often get the question here, so has Britain now become the laughingstock of Europe? And I think it would be good, actually, if some British correspondents, especially in Germany or on the continent, as you say, go out and ask people, how do you feel about Britain now? And they will find that actually there's still the same love and there's still the same admiration for the people in Britain, not for the government, but for the people.
Meg Russell.
Well, in one sense, in terms of what's got lost in the debate, as a British politics specialist, pretty much everything else in British politics, and we quite like to get back to those things. On the constitutional level, one thing that we are a bit concerned about, we published a report on this week, is that we could walk into another referendum that we're not prepared for in the shape of a Northern Ireland border poll.
OK, right. Well, there's something to consider. That's it for this week. My thanks to Nairi Woods, Sam Lowe, Meg Russell and Stephanie Bolton. And we'll be back at the same time next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producer was Jim Frank, the editor was Jesper Corbett, and the production coordinator was Icky Egbertola. If you'd like to listen to more episodes, you can catch up by going to BBC Sounds. We've got quite a library on there now.